Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and even though I thought I would never do another solo shot at podcasting again, hey, you know what? This one's going to be so impromptu, it's so fresh in my head right now, I figured, why not do it again? So, with that said, basically, I am here to weigh in with my review of a return to one of HBO's most, let's say, beloved franchises with the many taints of Newark. Oops. I mean, saints. Taints, that would probably be a return to the deuce, I guess, not the Sopranos. And before I wrap up the podcast, I will toss in my 2 cents in on Netflix's Squid Game. Oh, by the way, in case you didn't know from any of the previous podcasts over the years, there will be spoilers throughout for both Saints and Squids, so be fair warned if you listen any further. Okay, let's kick this off with The Many Saints of Newark, a Soprano story, which was directed by Alan Taylor, whose work on TV is impeccable, with tons of episodes of The Sopranos, Mad Men, Game of Thrones, and so on, all under his belt. Maybe his work in big budget franchises like Thor Dark World or Terminator Genesis, not so much. And of course it was written by Sopranos creator himself, David Chase, along with Lawrence Connor, who also has some nice TV work on display on his mantle, such as episodes of things like The Sopranos and Boardwalk Empire. His film-wise, again, he's also a little bit spotty, like that awful Tim Burton take on Planet of the Apes. And would you believe this guy, this guy is credited with the screenplay for Superman 4, The Quest for Peace? Oh boy. But you know what? He did do one of the best Star Trek movies with Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. Now, this, we'll call it a movie. Let's say I was looking forward to it, but with tempered expectations. Now, I confess I am one of those folks who actually revised his original opinion on the final episode of the original series. I mean, when I excoriated it when it first aired back in 2007, you know, I was livid. I wrote a blog and everything all about it. But within a year or two after a rewatch of the series and some heavier thinking on my part, not to mention the fact I became a lot more serious about the craft of writing overall, I became a convert. I know many, even some very close friends of mine, still hate that ending. Hey, you know what? There were plenty of things I really grew to dislike to some extent over the course of the last 3 seasons of The Sopranos. And you know what? I'm saying you know what a lot already. More than one rewatch has only confirmed some of those things for me. But the finale isn't one of them. The not knowing is the point of the end. The fact that this is the life Tony Soprano has built for himself, that at any given moment, someone could suddenly burst in with guns a-blazing, that even the quiet times, even the times when the family is finally truly a family, dread lurks around every corner, be it hiding in the restroom or biding their time at the coffee shop counter. The reason why I think it works is because this has always been the case. We just haven't thought about it that way. At least it's always been the case since Tony Soprano stopped being a civilian, which was basically when he was still in school. Because remember, he's not like Walter White, whose shift into criminality and true villainy pretty much happened over the course of a year. Or someone like The Shield's Vic Mackey, whose murderous misdeeds only went back so far, and with a few notable exceptions, his was not a lifetime of corruption and sin. But this, with The Sopranos, that is the life of a mobster. It is the life of Tony Soprano. Now, many claim they would have been happy or satisfied if Tony had gotten whacked in the final episode. I'm sorry, I kind of doubt that. I also doubt they would have been happy if Tony had gone to prison. So what would be left? Tony triumphant? Look, if you watch The Sopranos or anything mob-related ever, triumphs are always short-lived in the mob life. Now, The more you think about it, if you really do, the more you may come to realize it's the lack of a true conclusion is what makes it a satisfying ending, because most of the best stories don't truly end. And just to be silly, I mean, come on, Casablanca. Rick and Louis don't just simply fade out of existence. They go off traveling together. They're on the run from the Nazis. They're likely getting up to no good or bad, whether they go back to the U.S. or on some remote island somewhere. Or Citizen Kane, do you actually think no one ever tried to figure out what Rosebud meant after those reporters leave the darkened room? Of course they did. Or Deuce Bigelow, European Gigolo. You know there had to be a wedding night between the penis-nosed woman and the vagina-mouthed woman, and yeah, maybe I better stop there. So, I just spent a lot of time talking about the Sopranos finale. I'm supposed to be talking about the many saints of Newark. So let me do that. Now, when you have a movie that is in any way a spinoff, a sequel, a prequel, an extension, expansion, or whatever it is of any already existing TV universe, at least when it comes to the initial effort, if not more, you kind of have to grade it on a couple different levels. You know, how well does it fit in with the stories and that universe that has already been established, and how well it actually stands alone as a feature film, a fully fleshed out story by itself. And warning or spoiler or whatever, well, you will know I'm hitting the end of this little many saints spiel when I bring up another yardstick for comparison, both good and bad. And that would be El Camino, the Breaking Bad movie that came out 6 years after that original series ended. Considering they're both feature-length stories derived from two of the most acclaimed series of the 21st century, hell, of all time, and they both have a similar tag after their title, you know, a Breaking Bad story, a Sopranos story. Come on, how could I not? And let's remove one dumb thing I've heard around the times of both releases. Anyone going on and on or going off and off about any movies or TV series or what have you and calling them unnecessary. Saying that from the outset is a stupid criticism. Even if a series had a perfect ending, if you can come up with another idea that's part of that universe that doesn't sully or step on that great conclusion, then by all means do it. I mean, not necessary. You could say that about pretty much anything and everything outside of, I don't know, food, shelter, and clothing. However, and here we go with my little caveat, with that said, it actually can become a valid criticism after the product, the film, the series, whatever it is unveiled. And it's kind of hard not to nod along with the kind of unnecessary view after you've finished watching The Many Saints of Newark. Can I just call it The Many Saints from now on? I'm just going to call it The Many Saints. It's too much to say. Number one, did we truly learn anything about Tony Soprano that we didn't already know before that would in any way enrich or really further color and deepen in his character were we to ever rewatch The Sopranos again? I don't think so. I think more it kind of steps on something that had been established on the series through a few flashbacks as well as Tony's own words. And that's how he looked up to his father, the awe in which Tony held his father. In many ways, we were led to believe that led to his entry into mobster life. With this movie, the connection between Tony and his dad, it feels more tenuous, more distant. And it's the more spoken about but never seen in flashbacks, Dickie Malsante, who's Christopher's dad, that Tony really seems to have a bit of hero worship for. And honestly, if you watch this movie, does that really ever feel earned? I mean, I can see him being a favorite uncle. Fine with that. Makes perfect sense. But not really much more than that. So I feel like it might have been an unintended retcon that doesn't really stick. And by that, what do I mean? I mean it fails. So beyond that, which both doesn't work and actually does fall into the needless category, what else do we learn? Oh, okay. Uncle June is actually behind the death of Dickie Maltasante. You know what? Okay, that's kind of interesting, especially when you look at the early days of Chris, you know, robbing from Uncle June's trucks and how Junior would react to Chris back then. Is it interesting enough to build a film around? No. And we already knew how characters like Junior were ridiculously petty and would murder someone over the dumbest of things. I mean, we practically had a gang war due to comments about cunnilingus and therapy in the great, great, great season one of The Sopranos. But otherwise, what else do we get here? We get a nice story about Livia and young Tony. It doesn't last much longer than the telling of that brief tale. You know, apparently then we find out Tony was trying to get his mom pills to help her. And these pills were in Maltasanti's pocket when he got executed. And I would file that under the whoop-de-doo category. And then you have to sit and watch all these people doing impressions of Sopranos characters. Corey Stahl, actor we all like, or should all like, he gamely tries on a number of lines that Dominic Chianese was known for when he played Uncle June. And, you know, mostly curse words. Meh. Or the guy, the actor who played Leonard or on the first season of Umbrella Academy. I think it was Leonard Peabody. This is his full character's name. He does everything he can possibly do to out-cartoon the memorable Stevie Van Zandt Silvio Dante. But, oh, by the way, I honestly had no idea Silvio was supposed to be that much older than Tony. I mean, quite frankly, it seems like his entire crew that we came to know watching The Sopranos, they were all at least 15 to 20 years older than he was, which seems kind of weird and strange to me. Not to mention, then you see younger versions of everybody else, you know, Big Pussy, Carmella, Artie Bucco even. I mean, I didn't know how spot on I was when I mocked this movie a week ago, calling it The Muppet Babies of Newark, because I hadn't seen it yet. But after having watched it, yeah, wow. But we really get next to nothing about Tony Soprano or his mother or his father or his sisters or really anything that wasn't already accomplished with flashbacks or the spoken word on the original series. And yeah, that little detail about Junior actually being responsible for the death of Chris's dad is interesting, but really, is that really it? They create this entire feud and character from the past, Harold McBrayer, the black thug that used to work under Maltasanti, but this is a person who had never been mentioned in any way, shape, or form on The Sopranos. For what? Is this just a backdoor way to kick off a series around that character in the 70s? Really? Really? Because you really left a ton of room to make him an actual character rather than an emotional stick figure with the occasional obvious motivation. And that's a big problem overall for the many Saints of Newark. You can get away to some extent by not giving us much on younger versions of characters we've seen before, whether it's Tony or Silvio or Junior, because we can fill in some of it ourselves. And then it becomes a cute game of when will he say or do this, or look what they did with his hair, hoo-ha, whatever. But these characters spend too much time on screen to be so poorly drawn in this specific film. But what's worse are the new characters that we had not seen before. I already mentioned a couple of the issues with the Harold McBrayer character. His sole existence basically comes down to this. I work for Dickie Maltasanti. But you know what? I hate working for Dickie Maltasanti. So, you know what? I'm going to go against Dickie Maltasanti. I'm going to steal from him. I'm going to covet and eventually bed his mistress. And whenever possible, I'm going to try to kill him. Oh, yeah. I'm also going to care about the civil rights movement for maybe, I don't know, 20 seconds. So, like I said, a shell of motivations, but never feeling like a truly multidimensional character. But you know what? They don't do much better with the main character, who turns out for this movie to be Dickie Maltasanti. I mean, he's basically a conglomeration of every single mobster cliche and, oh wait, no, that's actually the first character that Ray Liotta plays, not Dickie. But Maltasanti, ugh, it's like having an empty core at the center of your story. Because even when he's involved in major events in action, be it a shootout or murdering either his dad or his mistress, yeah, he's a great guy, this one. Doesn't it always feel like we're just watching some side character we don't really care all that much about? Not to mention, I gotta confess, I spent half the time watching this actor in this film, Alessandro Nivola, and I kept thinking, man, if they ever do an Andrew Cuomo movie, this is the guy for that part. But there's nothing about him to form an emotional connection to the audience. It just all felt so Well, like I said, empty, like a sketch of ideas knitted together without a truly worthwhile story to make it, well, I'll use the word I might have overused earlier when I was talking about the finale, to make it satisfying. So while David Chase clearly had some great ambitions that fueled the making of this film, it really never justifies its existence. It never comes close to the pantheon of mob films it so clearly emulates. Or even the original series that spawned it, for that matter. I mean, look, it looks great. It's a cinematic looking as hell. But two things. Number one, The Sopranos was also an exceptionally well-shot and directed series. And if you strip away the period look of the cars and the fashions, to say that this is any different or better, I would think is disingenuous at best and kind of dumb and wrong at worst. Because remember, the guy who did this, who directed it, he already shot 8 or 9 episodes of the series. A period look and good art direction do not a good movie make. Not if that's all you got. Because I can think back to, when was it? 2006, I think, maybe. When Brian De Palma's The Black Dahlia came out in theaters. And oh man, oh, did that look good. It looked great. The 40s style, the cars, the architecture, the film noir of it all. I mean, it looked fantastic. But oh yeah, it was also awful and laughable and one of my least favorite film experiences of the past 20 years, which was shocking at the time because everything about that movie, it should have been in my wheelhouse. And this wasn't just the dopey, the book is better than the movie syndrome. It was just a mess. And while I wouldn't call The Many Saints of Newark a mess, I wouldn't call it a very good movie either. It's a shadow of a movie. It's a blueprint of scenes that need more work, even if it meant an additional half an hour. Or maybe you cut out some of the hokey nods to the original series that kind of fall flat anyway. Now, I mentioned earlier El Camino way back when. El Camino, if you guys will remember, didn't have any of the lofty aspirations of Many Saints. I mean, it was released in theaters for, what, maybe a week or so? But it was always seen and felt like what it turned out to be, a continuation of the TV series. It was probably less a standalone feature film and more like two new episodes of the series, and shifted the focus from the main character, Walter White, to character 1A, Jesse Pinkman. It would be like getting a couple new Mad Men episodes a few years after Mad Men ended, which gave us some more of what became of Peggy Olson. And El Camino does answer questions many of us had at the conclusion of that series, namely, what was going to become of Jesse? So whereas Many Saints never really feels like it gels with the Sopranos universe, it feels forced, if anything, El Camino could easily be episode 63 and 64 of Breaking Bad. And yeah, admittedly, El Camino maybe doesn't work quite as well as a standalone film. I mean, honestly, it's impossible to see and really get that film unless you've watched the entire Breaking Bad series, I would say. It's still comes in with a tight and well-constructed story in its running time. You know who to root for, who to root against. You know what the stakes are, and so on. You don't really ever get that with Many Saints. It's Goodfellas light. Oh, by the way, having Ray Liotta in this thing in not one but two parts, I mean, twins, whatever, probably doesn't help reminding us of something that he did that was like 10,000 times better. I don't really have much else to say as far as Many Saints is concerned. I mean, yeah, I guess I should mention it was nice and even sweet to see Michael Gandolfini playing a teenage version of the character his dad made so iconic. You can see the occasional mannerism here or the way he carries himself there as nods to his dad. But is that reason enough to recommend this? Not really. It's at best, okay. And there are just too many things to watch and stream out there for me to feel comfortable advising anyone to add this to their viewing list. Now, I could just end it there. Wow, it'll be our quickest podcast ever. But I did say I wanted to say a little something, or maybe two or three little somethings, about Squid Game. That's the Korean series that's been lighting up the Netflix universe as well as Twitter and so on. It's vaguely reminiscent of a Japanese film from about 20 years ago called Battle Royale. That was essentially the Hunger Games before there was a Hunger Games, only way more violent and bloody. You know, so the concept of people being brought somewhere to compete with each other and the losers of every game being brutally killed. So it's got the elements of that. You know, it's got elements of things like, you know, Running Man or The Most Dangerous Game. It's really a hodgepodge of all those similar elements and tropes, but then they're stripped down to their essentials. And it really comes down to how easy or difficult it is for one to give up their soul for greed, and how man's inhumanity to man will always be the most pervasive plague on our society. Now, based on the construction of the story, we know who our main character is going in. It's Seong Ji-hun, or number 456 if you prefer. So you kind of know from the start he's going to make it to the end. Oh, they do get you thinking once or twice they might be pulling a Marion Crane or a Ned Stark here and knock off the main character before we get to the climax. But yeah, you pretty much know it. The real question is, how many are going to make it to that final round? Will it be just two or three or four? I will say I assumed it was going to be three until the remainder of the glass bridge is, I'm just going to say, inexplicably blown apart towards the end of the seventh episode. Really, they accomplished the task. So for frontman or whoever to push that button to blow up, you know, the remaining glass panels of the bridge, which was obviously going to send all these glass shards hurtling at them, seemed out of character for the game, if that makes any sense. They had already won. Why do something that would in any way impede them or hurt them going into the next one? That kind of bothered me. So then later when we see that the girl, and I hope I don't pronounce, I'm probably going to mispronounce every name here, Kang Sai-byuk. Wow, I know I butchered that. The only part I didn't butcher was Kang. Sai-byuk? Whatever. She has a massive shard of glass sticking out of her abdomen. Yeah. At that point, you know it's going to come down to, say, 456 and Sang-woo. See, he's got a name I can pronounce, no problem. Now look, a series like this is hardly the stuff of prestigious awards. It works astonishingly well on a purely visceral basis. That's why Hunger Games and Battle Royale, or even way cheesier things like, I don't know, Death Race 2000. I mentioned Running Man before. There's a few other Stephen King stories like that. They pull in a viewer or a reader and they don't let go until it's over. It doesn't matter how over the top or outlandish it gets. You still get it. You still can imagine yourself in such a circumstance. And honestly, it's not really that much different than the appeal of watching a reality competition series, like say a Survivor or a Big Brother, except beyond it being totally fiction here, the contestants die, and most times quite horrifically. Now, as far as the overall series, I almost think it goes without saying the sixth episode is the most gut-wrenching of the nine. Oof. Then in the subsequent episode, the glass bridge scene is ingenious and pretty much nerve-wracking. I mean, I guess you could say that about almost all the games they play. But oddly enough for me, I kind of felt the series ran out of a lot of steam once we get past the glass bridge sequence. I mean, the eighth episode was super short and almost kind of felt like a shrug just to get ready for the final episode. And since a lot of that was based around the frontman character, let me pop in here to point out or to ask y'all out there who've watched the series, and that would be why you're listening, I would think. Did anyone really like or believe the storyline between the cop and the front man? Look, I am all about accepting some level of coincidence and suspension of disbelief, but the reveal between those two, I just stared at the screen with a bit of, really? But how? But why? But nah, I don't care. So we get to the final episode, you get the final battle, and it's funny how the series is named Squid Game. And the least interesting game of all the rounds is Squid Game, at least for me. That aside, because I'm not here to critique children's games. Otherwise, the whole sequence is done reasonably well, you know, reducing man to his most primal and violent form, you know, and then we get the twist we know must be on the agenda afterwards, because there's simply too much time left in the episode. And we're probably spending too much time getting annoyed that, you know, Ji-hun has not, as of yet, kept his promise to help out all the families of those people that he had promised. I mean, come on, dude. Mopey, hang yourself with a ropey or something, but keep a damn word. I mean, you ended up leaving your kid brother in the orphanage for an extra year because you were just, you know, sulking around. Oof. Anyway, the big reveal. Look, I was okay with it. I can't say I saw it coming. That would be a lie. But it didn't leave me speechless either. It kind of just felt more like an, oh, of course, that makes perfect sense. Although the pissing himself part now really feels weird and odd when I look back, but, you know, old man, you do you, I guess. And I will also admit, I got a little annoyed at the very, very, very ending. I don't care if they're setting up a sequel. I was still like, but dude, your daughter, dude. Jeez. They better have a scene at the start of the next one where he's like, he's made out a will or something so that all that money goes to his kid. So at least there would be that, an acknowledgement of that. Oh, yeah. And to be clear, as I'm recording this, there's been no sequel announced. But come on, it's a global phenomenon. There's going to be a sequel. Anyway, finally, it's just a fun binge watch. And you can choose to watch with the English dubbing or in the original Korean with subtitles. Hey, look, and I'm not going to come down on anybody who chooses the dub versions. Jeez, if millions could make it through most of Sergio Leone's spaghetti westerns or the first Mad Max movie or any number of Japanese monster movies over the years and really not have much of an issue with the English dubbing, then why not this? I mean, I know I didn't sound that way when I talked about Dark with Dan, you know, over the years, even though I'll admit I did watch some of Dark in the dub version a little. And I'll further admit, as I watched Squid Game, I actually switched back and forth throughout my viewing. Both I went back and forth between watching it in Korean and watching it with the English dub. I would actually rewatch a number of scenes both ways to see if they landed better in the original Korean or English. Because I know you'd all would assume it would land better or feel more emotional in the original Korean. But the voice work isn't that bad. I don't know. Maybe I'm being more forgiving of it. I don't know. Either way, it's a fun watch, no matter what version you choose to watch. So I'm going to end my little somewhat impromptu podcast recording here. So if you like this podcast, chances are you will like hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. Like the page and join the conversation about shows like Squid Game. Or you could talk about that Many Saints thing. But, you know, or better yet, talk about The Sopranos because it's a lot better. Now, you can find our podcast pretty much everywhere a podcast can be found, except for maybe Pandora, I guess. But you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, and so on. But better still, you can find all 25 of our podcasts over at stvdpodcast.podbean.com. Finally, follow us on these two places. Follow us on Instagram. It's kind of cool. Our Instagram handle is Serious TV Drama, all is one word. How hard is that to find? Why not? Why not add? And Twitter, you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle there, as always, is at stvdpodcast. Wow. Podcast? STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama. Now, upcoming, I would say at some point in the next week or two, haven't spoken to him about it. We just have busy schedules. Brian and I will regroup for some more Doom Patrol talk. I am not sure if I'll include Why the Last Man in there as well. Maybe. I don't know. I'm probably going to mention that I just heard that the Flash is going to have yellow or gold boots in the final season. Yay, I saw photos, but no one cares but me. And definitely at month's end, Dan and I will be bringing you part two of Breaking Bad season 3. So that about does it. Till next time, thanks for listening, and good night.